All right. So, welcome back to the Beit Midrash for the next installment here of our Talmud Shiur, our Talmud class. So, we started last week with a pretty long precia, hakdama, preface of sorts about Masechet Tanit. And I highly recommend that if you want to get that whole background and how we introduced it, that you listen in to the recording that we're posting for the class. This week, I'm going to jump pretty quickly into the Mishnah on 2A1, if you're in the Schottenstein edition, the first Mishnah of the Masechta in Tanit. But I will just read you a very short piece from an article that I found on drought in the ancient world, which quotes a text that we should just have in mind, which is a Midrash, which is the same rabbinic era text that the Mishnah and the Gemara is coming from. There's strata that are very early in Genesis Rabbah, which may precede the Mishnah itself, but texts are there, both early and later texts are there. And it says, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said the following, three things are weighed equally. In other words, are in a certain sense judged. And they are the earth, haaretz, humans, Adam, and rain, matar. Meaning that within the sense of what has a day that God judges them, that each of these three has its day in court. Each of these three really would be some of the, if you will, the three pillars that are both judged and upon which the world stands. Rabbi Levi Bar Chiyasa says, the three of them are written with three letters to teach you that without earth there would be no rain, aretz matar, using matar as precipitation. That each of these three words are written with three letters to teach you that without earth there would be no rain, and without rain there would be no earth, and without the two of them there would be no humans. Now, I bring that for a couple of reasons. One is, so important is the entire matter, we have an entire Masechta, which we know. Two is that the Midrash, when it makes the move to make a limud, to teach something about these matters and about our understanding of their place within the universe, and that God judges them, and that God sustains these two in order so that human beings can enjoy the world, that philosophically there's some deep message. One is, in the limud itself, that the world, both haaretz and matar, and precipitation, serves to create the place for humanity. And that in our tradition, God indeed decided very much to create the world and matar, precipitation, for human beings. That, remember the story we heard on High Holidays this year even. God throws aside, casts aside, and Charlie repeated it in his Chabura. God casts aside truth and says, I know they're going to even tell a lie or two. I want to create the world. And not only that, when I say the world, I mean human beings. But what does the human being need? The world and rain. And even though we want to say sometimes, just in our kind of quick mindsets, God created the whole world for human beings, and we mean everything in the world, the Midrash goes to the next step and says, the world meaning haaretz, the land and all that's there, and matar, precipitation. So that we understand what serves humanity, or gives the chance for humanity to thrive, to be partners with God in creation, if you want to go that route in terms of philosophically. The other piece that comes to light is that the rabbis are very serious about making lessons spring forth from the grammar and the spelling and the alphabet of creation that's represented by the Hebrew words that are right in front of them. And they take this very seriously. Right? You've heard me say before in this class, Professor Heinemann, the famous quip that I learned from my teacher, Mark Bregman, a Midrashist, and someone who created the whole new understanding, scholarly versions of Tanhuma, and what that Midrash is really all about. Anyhow, he says, Professor Heinemann, he always reminded us, the rabbis thought these were absolute holy words, and the Midrashim that are about either letters or words are some of the holiest word games that anybody has ever played. That's how he would frame it. And when they do this, they're really unlocking the mysteries of a holy communication to the world, God the divine, who speaks through this language of creation, and they're unlocking the mysteries because text is that holy. It's a holy vessel. And not just the meaning of it, as in the interpretation that I make, the understandings I glean, but it is holy in and of itself. So that when there's an extra letter here and there, I'm going to learn something incredible about what goes on in the Torah, what goes on in verses of Tanakh, what goes on in the way a Midrash builds out an understanding, and how points and nekudot and the small little symbols of whatever is in use can impact our understanding of our relationship with God, what God does for the world, what we have to understand in terms of halakha. So not just the number of repetitions and not just, again, interpretive understandings or what we glean in terms of what the text is saying, but how the text says it, what letters it uses, what letters it adds, what letters it takes away, what letters it's missing, what letters seem extra. And we're going to get to that by the end of the first daf of the Gemara. So the reason why I wanted to point this out here, over here in this extra text, is to say we have that come into focus as well in our Gemara. And we can't just see them, or we can, if sometimes seems, lack of better terms, almost cute, right? But it's not just that. It's that there's a whole dimension of Kedusha. There's a dimension of deep holiness that the rabbis are seeing within the spellings of the words of Torah. What's in the verses, what they contain. And so I want to just make that preface tonight before we jump back, really, to the beginning of the daf, and let's go into the Mishnah. Remember we said the Me'ematai, the when, parallels the Me'ematai of Masechet Brachot, and it's as if we've already determined what's the halacha, that we have to pray and that we have to make sure that we understand how to say the Amidah, and that there are certain insertions within a certain part of the Amidah. And when, though, mazkirin gevurot geshamim, we ask, when do we mention gevurot geshamim, the powers of rainmaking, that God has the powers of rainmaking. Gevurot is a plural word, right? Not, and in the sense it's the collective plural, the powers of rain. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer is going to be our first opinion. And of course, we didn't say this last time, but I just want to point out, when we think about Rabbi Eliezer, we have to remember that his partner in argumentation, his chevruta, or his colleague, one of his major colleagues, is Rabbi Yehoshua. And the two of them, together, are an important pair all over the Talmud. And we'll leave it at that for now, but we'll come back to that at a good point to really talk about these two, who represent in a certain way, though they are all students, both students, of Yochanan ben Zakkai, Tanaim of the Mishnah, all of them. Yochanan ben Zakkai is the one that they sneak out of Jerusalem, and he creates the next academy and the academy at Yavne, and that's going to lead to the whole project of the Mishnah. These two are colleagues, they are students of the same Rebbe, if you will, but in a certain way they represent Shammai Hillel argumentation. In a certain way, they represent a very small c conservative approach to a more interpretive rabbinic culture dynamic approach in terms of text. So when we see these two names, we're immediately thrown into a world of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, which is the drama, for those who have heard about it, of the Tanur Shel Achnai, the oven over which they had lots of argumentation, right? And whether or not it was kosher, whether or not it was pure. And then the Beit Midrash and the story there of whether or not Rabbi Eliezer's conservative opinion or the majority's opinion that Rabbi Yoshua represented could be used, and then the notion of Rabbi Eliezer being told, listen, you're right, but the halakha is not like God or you, it's like Rabbi Yoshua and the majority. This is the drama that's brought up immediately when we're when we see and introduced to a disagreement in the beginning of a Mishnah that's already over here in Tani. Right? So we have to kind of hypertext ourselves to these two who are really a pair who represent a great dynamic within Tanaitic literature. Tana being a rabbi from the Mishnah, just as a reminder. Okay, so Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Miyom Tov HaRishon Shel Chag. Rabbi Eliezer says that it's from the first day of the Chag, meaning of Sukkot. And Rabbi Yoshua Omer, Miyom Tov HaAcharon Shel Chag, that is the day that Shmini Atzeret. Basic reason. Well, if you say it on the first day of Sukkot, and you're asking for rain while you're supposed to be sitting in the sukkah, you have a problem. You don't want to have rain come during the festival of Sukkot. You want to have rain come afterwards. Let's see if there's more to it. Amar Rabbi Yoshua, Ha'il Vein Hageshemim Eila Simon Klala B'Chag. Lama Hu Mazkir. So he says it's not only that you don't want it. It's a Simon Klala. It's a like a curse. What does Rashi say? What is that Simon Klala? What's it like? It's very negative. It's very negative if that's going to happen. He says it's a, what does it say in English? It's a sign of a curse. It exempts one from the mitzvah of sukkah, right? Though it's natural, but it's a curse. Why should he say? Why should he bring down the rain? Now, how's he using Mazkir here, by the way? As in Mivakesh. Why should you request the rain on Sukkot if it's going to be a curse? If it's going to ruin your Sukkot, if it's going to ruin our chance to do the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah. Rashi says, Kedamina b'masechet sukkah perek hayashan. The one in the chapter that's about sleeping in your sukkah, so it's not just even about being in the sukkah for Kiddush on the first night. Rashi is going to bring you part of the chapter where it says, not only do you have the responsibility, because there's going to be an argument later, do I have any real chiyuv, do I have any real obligation to be in my sukkah more than the first night of Sukkot? Can't I just fulfill my obligation and then not be there? And he's going to say, in the perek, in the chapter where I talk about sleeping there, meaning, I got a lot of mitzvot to do in the sukkah during the week of Sukkot. I don't just have Kiddush the first night in the sukkah, if that's what you might be thinking. I don't just have one Kiddush and one day Yom Div to keep. I got a whole week to live there. I got a whole week to sleep there. Me'ei matai mutar lefanot me'et hisrach mishin tisrach ha-makva mishel la'avod. Shabalim zog kod. Oh, the eved. Oh, mashallah. I'm sorry. So you've got this from. So the notion is going to be a curse. And when is it possible? And here's the issue that I'm dealing with. When is it possible to really leave your sukkah? From the moment that it's going to rain. What is this from the moment it's raining? Really likened to? What's the mashal that I'm going to bring? Le'eved shebalim zog kos l'rabo. There's a eved that there's a servant that is going to go and pour a cup for his master, right? We're the eved, right? We're the servants, and we want to serve our master, that is God, by doing what? Sitting in the sukkah. V'shafachlo kitun al panav, and he throws water in his face. So it's like you're saying to your servant, with a cup of water, splash in your face, get out of here. I don't need your services. When you asked us to do the mitzvah, and you want us to do the mitzvah, and we as the servants want to serve, and we want to serve God by sitting in the sukkah, but then you pour the cup of water right in our face. That's what we want from our master. That's what we want from the King of Kings at that moment, to not be able to serve him, to actually be sent away. No, we want to be able to have this chance. So Rabbi Yeshua is saying to Rabbi Eliezer, can't be from the first day. Amar lo Rabbi Eliezer, afani lo amarti lishol. Remember, he says, I didn't say that he should ask for rain, request rain at the beginning of Sukkot. Elo lahazkir mashiva ruach umrita gashem be'onato. Rather, I'm saying that we have this liturgical insertion in our Amidah at Sukkot time to say, really, that's the time that the rains do start, that the winter season begins, that precipitation is going to come, and I'm cognizant of that, and I recognize that in my tefillah. And granted, it sounds like when I say lahazkir, and this is the lashon of the Mishnah, this is the language of the Mishnah now that we're really dealing with internally here, it may sound like I'm saying requested, but when I say lahazkir, I'm not talking about rishol, I'm not talking about livakesh, I'm not talking about requesting rain, I'm talking about lahazkir, to mention the powers of rain, gvurot kishamim, that God has the essential power to send the rain, and that the rain comes at this time. So when the rain comes, I recognize that it's not just simply coming because I did anything. We didn't seed any clouds. There's no science that's going to allow me to create the storm, even though, you know, you want to talk about projects out there in the world. Those of you who are familiar with any of these cloud seeding, rain-making kind of projects that are going on that we can read about, at least from the last, you know, several decades, right? People wondering, are we going to get to this place? Are we going to get, if they can make snow on a mountain to ski, can't they make rain for a farm? These are the big questions scientifically that are going on in that field. But I'm talking about recognizing that God has the power of creating the rain at this time. Amar lo, but he says to him, Rabbi Yeshua says, well, wait a minute, if you're talking about recognizing that God is the power who creates the precipitation in the first place, and we want to recognize God's power for having God's power, im kein la'olam yehei mazkir, let him say it all year, ein sholin at the geshamim, eila samuch l'geshamim. So, if you don't really want to make it a request, let him say it forever. And we're going to go back and just end with Olam Yehei Mazkir. We should mention it all times. Ein Sholin Et HaGeshamim Ela Samuch LaGeshamim says a different thing. And the reason why I read through is because we said last time, it sounds like it could be a continuation of the same issue in the Mishnah, except that the Mishnah kind of stops the issue of this question about when we mention the powers. La'olam yehei mazkir, period. And then the Mishnah is going to make a ruling that doesn't sound like it's really a ruling, and it's really not a ruling about this conversation. This conversation is kind of about the gevurot geshamim in the second blessing of the Amidah, in terms of when we start saying it. But it does pick up on the question, when do we really then start to ask for it? The asking for the rain is in a different blessing of the Amidah, if you recall. So it's not in the second blessing, the Gevurot blessing, the powers blessing, the second blessing of the Amidah. It really comes, and we saw this on the sheet that we took from our Sidur, from the Amidah, that you have the Barech blessing in the Amidah, in the center blessings, in the middle blessings of our Shmona Esrei, of our typical weekday Amidah. I'm not talking about Shabbat either. I'm talking about a weekday Amidah. So, yes, we do make a request. The Mishnah forgets to say idiomatically, like, let's end that conversation about Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua's disagreement. Oh, and by the way, we know we make a request for rain. We do that in a different blessing, so let's make a ruling now about that request we do make for rain in Barech, and get out of this conversation about Atah Gibor. That's the jump that the Mishnah made without giving us any transition or kind of bridging language. And it says, you don't request rain, you don't ask for rain, until the rainy season. So here's how it goes again, in short form. When do we say Gevurot Geshemim? Mashiv Aruch Umorid HaGashem? In the second blessing of the Amidah? Rabbi Eliezer says first day Yantiv. Rabbi Yoshua says Shmini Atzeret. Why on Shmini Atzeret? Because already, to most opinions, you're out of your sukkah. You've left. Rabbi Eliezer says, okay, I think I'm right. Rabbi Yoshua says, I think I'm right. And Rabbi Yoshua says to Rabbi Eliezer, well, why are you saying at the beginning? Because you want rain at the beginning of Sukkot. That's not a great idea. He said, no, I didn't say you're supposed to request rain at the beginning of Sukkot. I just said you recognize God's power. And Rabbi Yoshua says, well, then, if that's the case, that God has his power to be the rainmaker, the precipitation maker, say it all year. And that is left open. What's halacha, by the way? Do we start and stop? Sweet. Yes, we do. So who quote unquote won that argument? Rabbi Eliezer. Except Rabbi Eliezer didn't win by way of the day, but he wins by way of the svara. So we use Rabbi Yehoshua's opinion about Yom Tov Aharon, right? And we use Rabbi Eliezer's opinion that there's actually, or Rabbi Yehoshua's sense of the last day, we use Rabbi Yehoshua's technical date answer, but we're left with a question that he's now asking. If really we're talking about God's powers, why aren't we saying this all year? So in and of itself, the Mishnah has Rabbi Yoshua asking a question on his own ruling. Because he's agreeing that I need to find the date upon which we start to say this. But he's also now saying, in terms of the way the discussion unfolded, wait a minute, shouldn't we be saying this all year? Comes along the Mishnah, which is about another bracha in the Amidah, the Barech blessing, right? And the Barech blessing comes later, right? You have, by the way, first blessing, Avot. Second blessing is our powers blessing. The third blessing is our Kedusha. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Then you have understanding, Atachonin Ladam Da. Right? And then you have Geula. And then you have, let me go back through, get into weekday mindset. What, Sidur? You have tshuva, you have licha, you have forgiveness, you have redemption. So you're talking about inner blessings. 1, 2, 3, 4. Rifa'enu, 5. Heal us. Barech. Then you get to this, and the inner blessings of the Amidah, Barech blessing after several others, so you have a gap between the Gevurot blessings that we say Mashiva Ruach in, who causes the wind to blow, the rain to come, we recognize the powers, and this request. And the Mishnah goes on to say, you only request rain near the rainy season. So why is the Mishnah built like that? Why does the Mishnah jump from Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua's discussion of Mashiva Ruach and Merida Gashem for a second to we only request the rain during the rainy season?
We get more lucky.
It's a matter of...
You ask and you get.
Okay, so if you...
want to see your reward.
If you ask at the wrong time and nothing comes, then it looks like you have no influence at all, if you're looking for any kind of notion that there could be quote-unquote rainmakers among the human crowd. Two,
imagine how it would look to outsiders. If you're beseeching your God for rain, nothing's happening, maybe it's not a real God.
Yeah. They're going to say, Eino Koach. Yeah. He doesn't have any power. So we don't want to request rain at a time that it's unlikely really never happens. How's it going to look outside?
Yeah, well, two questions. One is, but we do, because it's in the weekday in the Baruch. In the weekday portion, aren't we asking for rain there? The other question was, because maybe it's understood, you're not asking for, you only ask for it because there's always a rainy season, but some seasons are rainier than others, and so you're asking in the season that it be a good season, not asking in the dry season for something which isn't supposed to happen.
Okay, so in terms of the actual something to happen, we don't ask for it. And by the way, on the seasonal kind of request that you say, okay, so during the winter season we're asking for it, but don't we ask for it during the other season? The reason why we don't mention at all matar or tal when we have the other season and during Barech in the summer between Passover and December 4th, which we went over last time. Why is it December 4th? Because they waited a whole period of time before we started asking for it in the diaspora. We just have the word bracha. We just have the word blessing. So we don't mention in the Barech blessing during the week rain or dew or precipitation. We just mentioned the general category of blessing, and that we want blessing in the year. So what's that blessing? Growth, that conditions shouldn't lead to a winter where we won't have rain, consistency in our seasons, all the things that we need to happen in the right way, but without really talking about rain, because you're talking about being in the ancient world there during that time, and it's really not happening. You know, you're going to get a wacky summer storm somewhere? Maybe. But we only say bracha. Alright, everybody clear with what's going on in that Barech blessing? Yeah?
So, by saying that you only have the blessing at the time of the rains, doesn't that turn Nishika Roach Morita Gashem back to being a request?
Well, see, this is why I read it in... I tried to read the Mishnah in continuously from Leolam Yehe Mazkir Eino Sholin Et HaGishamim Eila Smuch LaGishamim. Right? If I read the Mishnah with that sentence connected to forever, one should mention it at all times, right? And then the Mishnah says, well, ain sholin at the Geshemim, elo smuch l'Geshemim. If I'm still talking about Mashiv HaRuch HaMorida Gashem, and I read that little part as a response to Rabbi Yoshua, and the response is, no, you only ask for rain at the time of the rain, and we're still talking about Mashiv HaRuch HaMorida Gashem in the second blessing of the Amidah, right? then yes, the answer to your question is, it sounds like that's a request. But if I say hard stop, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua are finished talking about the second blessing. And the Mishnah comes and it rules about the Barech blessing in the middle of my Amidah, several blessings away from my second blessing, right? And I say it's talking about Tein Talu Matar Livracha, the request I make for actual dew and precipitation within the Barech blessing, then that ruling kind of gives me insight into the reason why both Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua could have picked a date around Sukkot, beginning of it, end of it, to start saying Mashiv HaRuach Umorid HaGashem. And since I only request rain during the rainy season, and we have good reasons for that, then I realize that no to Rabbi Yoshua, I leave off with the question, and I answer Rabbi Yoshua, I say no, then I shouldn't have to say Mashiv HaRuach Umorid HaGashem all year long.
So you're, I think what's confusing me, I think you're saying that he's saying you should say it all year round, and I took that to mean that, to be part of his argument, that because we know we don't say it all year round,
it's a request.
In other words, I took...
I see what you mean, but here's the thing. He accepts, because the second blessing is Atagibor Lelamarnai. It's a blessing about Gevurot. Rabbi Eliezer has taught him he didn't mean to say Lishol.
Yes, but the way I'm reading it, Yoshua is saying, but you're wrong when he says if you're only recognizing it as stating God's power rather than as a request, then we would say it all year round, but we don't say it all year round. So I'm still connecting it with the Meshiv HaRuach Le'olam, that's not what we do, as opposed to Barech is what we do.
Right, there are different ways to read this clause, and that's the point. Sometimes the Mishnah isn't exactly clear, but that's a nice read. You know, so you can either read it with its continuation of Rabbi Yoshua, as you're doing, right? You could say that, wait a minute, let's say this forever. But over here in Barech, I can gain some insight as to why there would even be an argument that says we shouldn't say it all year. And I take that from Barech.
Right.
So that's those are the two possibilities right there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And one of the other things why it's in this particular part of the year, wouldn't it be more that the prayer should be that there should be a normal amount of rain as opposed to torrential rains and that which could possibly devastate all crops?
Nice. Nice. So I think did I say last week that in the minyanim that I davened with, that I prayed with in Jerusalem, and in at least Iraqi shuls that I went to, Moroccan shuls that I went to, and Yemenite synagogue that I was in, when they say Mashiv HaRuach HaMorid HaGashem, or Geshem, depending on where you are, during the repetition, the community of those people praying say Livraha. They say for a blessing. That's an interesting, by the way, parallel to the bracha insertion that we put in the off-season versus the Tein Tal Umatar Livracha, give us dew and rain precipitation in the right amounts in the bless this year and make it a bountiful year blessing down the line, right? So that hope is one that has been expressed now, I imagine that oral tradition, I can't pinpoint when that tradition started in these minyanim that I have had the experience praying with, but I imagine it's there for generations. I don't see any manuscripts that have parenthetical remark, Livracha, near Mashiva Ruach HaMorid HaGashem. I'm starting to just look at that. If I can find one during our course of our study this year, it will be an interesting liturgical kind of note to make in terms of what we know. Yeah? Well, that's for sure. I meant right at Mashiva Ruach HaMorid HaGashem. This is a great parallel, by the way. Yeah. Yeah. Right in front of us, that we have the special notion of saying Livracha V'loli Klala, three times.
A totally different question, if I can. Do we need the wind, does Palestine need the wind in order to have rain?
Yes, and we talked about that being part and parcel of when water comes and seed is being blown and the right kind of rains are moved towards the hillside and in a way you have different storm patterns and systems that the wind acts as like the, if you will, the sprinkler head, in addition to it just being there to produce some of the effect that nature in and of itself exhibits. Right.
The wind also for spreading of the seed?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Not moving the rain.
Well, I think it is for both.
Yeah.
I would say that it's both for the seed and it's for kind of natural goings on of I'm not a scientific expert in these, but I've read a little bit. I like this Journal of Ancient Botany, and the insects themselves, as I understand it, and I wish there was an entomologist who anybody knows an entomologist. I would love to discuss this. As I understand it, some insects who are involved in this process also are helped by the wind themselves to fly distances that they wouldn't get to otherwise. Right? We don't think about these kinds of things. We think, obviously there's only this far of a range. Well, it could be a longer range for a flying insect that helps the process. So you have lots of reasons why the wind would be important, and it's definitely something for us to continue thinking about. Obviously it's involved with the powers of rain that are being mentioned, and the wind in itself, very frankly, as I understand from meteorology as well, it moves the clouds, and the clouds then are moved into place and provides for the rain in their spots. So many reasons why you potentially have the rain and wind together. Okay, just to now go past that phrase that seems like it could be read in at least two ways. Mishnah presents now an opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Omer. And that's when it says Rabbi Yehuda, we're talking about Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, editor of the Mishnah, 200 CE, the one who's kind of the mazkir, the one who remembers all of these different discussions and opinions and is responsible ultimately for getting the Mishnah together, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ha'over lifnei ha'teva b'yom tova ha'ron shel chag, the one who goes before the Ark to lead the prayers on that last day of the festival, meaning on Shmini Atzeret, ha'aharon mazkir. And by the way, if you didn't think that it had been decided already that Rabbi Yehoshua was the one whom we rule by, because he says we don't ask for it until the time of the rainy season, and he interchanges the word mazkir and shoel all the way in Dale's reading, or he's just simply referring to, well, you told me already in the other blessing, Barech, you don't ask for it then, so yeah, I'm going to go with, we're going to only say Mashiva Ruach HaMorid HaGashem here now. He says, I have another understanding of how we do that in terms of starting this special either mention and or request, double request or mention and request system in our Amida prayer. However, the one who goes before the Ark to lead the prayers on the last Yom Tov of the festival, that's Shemini Atzeret. Ha'acharon Maskir, the latter one who leads the Musaf service, mentions Mashiva Ruach HaMorid HaGashem. Varishon, meaning the one who leads the Shacharit service, Eino Mazkir. The one who leads the Shacharit service. So what's the assumption? That in here, there wasn't the question, maybe it's Mincha after that. Maybe it's the Maariv the night before that we start. No. Here at the end of this Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda is talking about the Shacharit service of Shmini Atzeret. So now we're decided, it sounds like, that this is the time we do it. And it's the Musaf leader versus the Shacharit leader. And what could I say if I didn't know any of the Jewish law so far? What does that mean that the last person mentions it, Mazkir? So if I was just to say to you, the person who leads the Musaf service is the first one to mention it, what would that mean? Would that mean in his private Amida? Like we say in our private Amida, you may know that the Jewish law has come down to us and we actually do start saying it in the silent Amida, those of us who are in Shul for Shmini Atzeret. We do say that. That's what we do. But what does it sound like from the Mishnah? It sounds like the one who goes up and leads the service is the first one to actually say it, right? So when would that be? In what we call the repetition, right? The repetition of the Musaf Amida. There happens to be one Gaon, Seder Rav Amram Gaon, who holds that the private people, the people saying their silent Amida, don't say Mashiv HaRuach Umarit HaGashem first. That it's really the person leading the service who says it in the repetition of that Musaf Amida for Shmini Atzeret. The rest of the world kind of goes with the ancient Yerushalmi and Eretz Yisraeli opinion and normative halacha to this day that the one leading the service, when it says Mazkir, we make that almost into the verb remind everyone, and it says remind everybody about the fact that we start saying Mashiva Ruach Umarit HaGashem right now, and people in their private Amida then insert it, and the first repetition allowed for the year is the repetition of the Amida on Shmini Atzeret. So only Rav Amram Gaon has the system where the first time we hear it is the repetition, and you don't get to say it privately. The rest of the world says the prayer leader stands and says, "I'm reminding you, start saying Mashiv Baruch Umarit HaGashem," or if you don't have any extra words said from the bima because people were worried in the liturgical realities of life among Jewish people, don't say it out loud, like, you now must say Mashiv Baruch Umarit HaGashem. They would come up with a way of reminding them through sounds and knocks. So anybody ever been to a minyan where, you know, on Shmini Atzeret, there's no reminder, like I will say at the corner of the bima, remember we insert Mashiv Baruch Umarit HaGashem today, right? You might not hear any of those words, and the only thing you might hear at the beginning of that Amida, your private Amida, is, and everybody knows what that is. Everybody knows what that is. That same very unique sound to remind you of that Mashiv HaRuach Umarit HaGashem beginning on Shmini Atzeret might be used on a Rosh Chodesh, let's say, and we were all praying, and we had an insertion of the prayer Yaleh V'Yavo in Ritzeh, another of the later blessings of the Amida. So you might, instead of having someone remind you before Micha Mocha begins and some of the chanting, you might have someone go.
Yeah, I've heard that before. So, but I never associated it with, but it's really saying there's something changing or there's something new to take, be observant.
Correct. Something special in the Amida today.
Be careful when you're going through it.
Exactly. Don't forget.
Don't forget.
Because we have all kinds of laws about what happens if you forget to say it and how far into it do you have to be before you just go back and add it, and do you have to start the whole thing over again. So that's what those are.
So it's just a general alert is what that is.
Well, it's the alert that something is happening in your personal Amida.
Right, right. But it's not confined to this one thing.
Right. On the day that Mashiv HaRuach Umarit HaGashem is coming around, because everybody has a general sense It's the reminder to actually pay attention to it. Because in general, what they'll say is that the reminder goes out. We say Mashiva Rocham Rida Gashem, and 50% of the Jews or more will forget to say it. that's what might happen. Just like on Rosh Chodesh, you know, someone will remind you, Yalev Yavo. And then you finish your Amidah and you're like, I didn't say Yalev Yavo. That may not happen here, but it happens. It happens. You hear that. You hear that from us. Oh, I forgot it again. Okay. So we now have the way that it's done, and Rabbi Yehuda finishes that with the other end. He's going to, you know, finish it up and say, B'yom tov harishon shel Pesach, harishon mazkir, the first one who leads the shacharit service mentions the powers of rain, v'acharon eino mazkir, but the latter one who leads the musa service does not mention the powers of rain. And now we have this period of time defined within our year's liturgy experience of having started to say Mashiva Ruach HaMurid HaGashem and finishing Mashiva Ruach HaMurid HaGashem. And what's the argument that we were only talking about Mashiva Ruach HaMurid HaGashem, even with the vocabulary of Sholin? That we see that the end of the Mishnah is talking about the very specific time of Mashiva Ruach HaMurid HaGashem. Because we know, as I mentioned to you last time, when does the request really for Tein Talam Atah Livracha really begin? In Israel? The 7th of Cheshvan. It doesn't even start on this holiday. And why did it not start until the 7th of Cheshvan and coincide exactly at the time of Shmini Atzeret? They needed to get home. We can't ask for rain if you have all the pilgrims in Jerusalem who have to get home. That would also be a klala. But wait a minute, that's an argument for it not being about a request. That it's different than a request. Because if it was a request, I'd be saying, hey, why don't you start the rain right now? So I have lots of different ways of understanding these words based on some of the practices that are in place according to the halacha. Into the Gemara. Gemara asks, Tana Hechikai. What exactly is the Tana referring to, the Katani Me'ematai, when he asks, when do we begin to mention Mashiva Ruach HaMurid HaGashem? In other words, what's he building from? What's he building off? It seems like we're in the middle of a conversation here. When do you do this? When do you do what? And so, I need to know what the what is. We said last week already that it brings you into the middle of a practice of saying the Amidah with insertions that you know about. But the Gemara wants to say, oh, Tana Hatam Kai Dekatane, the Tana here in our Mishnah, in Tani, is referring to, or has in mind, a Mishnah from Tractate Brachot, Maskirin Gvuro Geshemim B'Tchiyat Ameti, that you actually say or mention the powers God has in terms of being a precipitation maker during the blessing that contains, and this is where we left off, the resurrection of the dead. Now that's the central theme of the second blessing of the Amidah. And we're going to get to a braita that's going, or a limud that shows us why those are connected today. The Sho'alin Bavir Karashanim. And this language of Sho'alin, this language of request, that's really about the Birkat Hashanim. That is the ninth blessing of the Shemona Esrei, and that is a different blessing. So when the Mishnah was talking about Sho'alin, that's where I get support for seeing that it made the jump over to Baruch. V'havdalah v'chonan adat, and when I'm talking about insertions into the Amidah, back there in Tractate Blessings, Brachot, oh, now I understand. This Mishnah, our Mishnah, was building off of the Mishnah that was in Tractate Brachot in Blessings, and it's filling in the picture that needs to be filled in if I'm talking about the times that we insert different prayers, liturgies, within the Amidah. So we have the power of rains in Tichyat HaMetim, that's our second blessing. The Sholim Bevirkat HaShanim, we have the request for rain in the ninth blessing of the Shemona Esrei. V'Havdala B'Chonen Adat, in the fourth blessing of the Amidah, we have the insertion of Havdala. Right? So people think that the Havdalah on Saturday night is the ceremony with the candle and the spices and the wine or whatever you have for the using for Havdalah. That's Tekes Havdalah. That's the ceremony of Havdalah. But the actual Havdalah, what allows you to actually pick up the matches, pick up the candle, hold these things that are muktzah, that are not available to you on Shabbat by way of Sabbath law, is that you've made Havdalah in the Maariv service during Chonem Hadat, during your Amidah. And there's a paragraph within the Amidah that is the Havdalah that you need to make. It has language of Havdalah familiar to us from the last blessing that we use in the Tekes Havdalah, the ceremony that is also used to make Havdalah over here on Saturday nights. But this Havdalah is the real Havdalah. This Havdalah is for the symbolic nature of, now that you've said Havdalah in your Maariv, go make Havdalah and have beautiful, it's a beautiful, very short, beautiful ceremony to really achieve a symbolic sense of now carrying Shabbat into your week, the light of the Sabbath, the light that first people created on the first Motzei Shabbos, the first time Shabbat went out, is where we get the fire tradition from, and that they should see the fire in their fingernails is really what the Gemara says about the seeing the fire and using the fire for work into the week is going to become symbolic there. And the spices are about your extra soul, and you're sad because your extra soul is leaving, and you want to just smell the sweetness. And so this ceremony brings you back to memories of the Sabbath. And the blessing at the end, which is Hamavdil ben Kodesh L'Chol, or L'Choshek, the one who separates from the 6 days and the seventh day, and is a repeat, is a summary for B'nai Bayit, for the children in the house, of the prayer you said in the Maariv service. And that's how most likely it developed. Where did that develop? Where do we get the notion of making a ceremony for Havdalah? Where is it important to teach the children all of what is important that we said over here? What Jewish custom centers on making sure the children know what the adults already know?
The Seder.
And so Havdalah comes, the ceremony of making Havdalah comes within the discussions of the four cups and the ceremonies of the Seder and the related Sabbath rituals that can be discussed once you start talking about wine and meals and all those things. And so that's the kind of roots of the Havdalah reality. And if we want to know where our Mishnah is stemming from, that's exactly the Mishnah that it's stemming from. V'katane, and our Mishnah teaches, Me'ema Taimas Kirin Givuro Geshamin. And so we're asking a question about mentioning the power that God has of making rain, basing ourselves on that Mishnah in blessings. So when they went back to discuss that Mishnah, this is where our Gemara discussion stems from. Okay? Good so far? Okay. Gemara asks, Felidnei Hatam, why'd you wait? Wait a minute. If we're talking about a Mishnah in blessings, Talmud Brachot, that was talking about where we insert all this stuff, why didn't it just teach about when we insert these phrases of liturgy over there in blessings? Why do I need this Masechta? Why do I need this Mishnah? Why do I need a Mishnah in and of... They're really asking two questions. Why wait till now in terms of the Mishnah? And do I really need a whole Masechta? Do I really need a whole tractate over here? Why can't it just be part of Talmud Brachot? Wasn't it so important? Wasn't it important enough? to actually have over there? Maishna devakshe adhacha. Why did he leave it until here? Brachot comes in a different order of the Mishnah. It's also kind of a philosophical question. Brachot is in the order of the Mishnah called Zra'in. Seeds. It's all about our relationship to nature. And of course, Brachot is about our relationship to God. Is Tani, does it fit with Moed? Does it fit with the order of Mishnah that has all the holidays in it? This is what the question is asking. I mean, we start out with Shabbat. We're kind of in all of the holidays here. I mean, this seems to be out of order in a certain sense. And so, behind all this is some question about what order does the Talmud get presented in? And where do I fit certain material? And this is kind of an internal editorial question, in addition to being a question now we're gleaning from. Turns out that Rambam has a Gemara that does not have the same order of tractates than pretty much the rest of the world in the Middle Ages. And Rambam's Gemara will order Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and then Tani in a kind of order that Yoma fits into very nicely, Yom Kippur fits into pretty nicely. The rest of the world will not have that exact order. He has more along the lines of the way the year pans out, and he doesn't move Tanit into Zera'im. He doesn't move it over near the tractate blessings. Nobody does. But he'll have it in a little bit of a different order. Just to say that there's a little bit of manuscript conversation and order of Talmud going on here, as much as there is anything else. The Gemara accepts the objection and proposes a different answer. In other words, so now I'm not resolved, because it could make sense that we should teach this over in blessings. Let's try a different tack. Eilat Tnama Rosh Hashanah Sali. Rather, the Tana's point of departure is a Mishnah in Tractate Rosh Hashanah. Because Tani's coming after Rosh Hashanah in most manuscripts, let's now see, can we figure out what's going on here? Ditnan, where we learned, Uvachag Midon Alamayim. It's said in Rosh Hashanah that on that day, what's Rosh Hashanah called? Who gets judged on Rosh Hashanah? What gets judged on Rosh Hashanah? Haaretz. The world. Who gets judged on Yom Kippur?
The human.
The human. What gets judged on the holiday of Sukkot? The rain. The rain. These are the three from Bereishit Rabbah that I started this evening with. There are three things that get judged, according to the Midrash, according to our tradition. One is the world. The world hangs in the balance. One mitzvah pushes God to the side of compassion, and the whole world is saved. That's Rosh Hashanah. Yom Hadin, Hayom Harat Olam, Hayom, right? Yami B'Mishpat. Kol Yisrael Olamim. The whole world is in the balance. So it's Haaretz on Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur, B'nai Adam. And Sukkot / Shmini Atzeret, rain. And because you're talking about these essential days of judgment, then I'm going to connect this to Rosh Hashanah. And what's nice about this is it makes the order of the Midrash I read earlier come into focus, and that is, first, Haaretz is there. Then, Matar is there. You have world and you have rain, and only then can you have humanity and the world for human beings, right? So now, if I go Rosh Hashanah, which is the world, and I go Tani, the Masechta, at least in terms of the orchestration of the Talmud, I get then the notion that, oh yes, because in Rosh Hashanah I mentioned that the world is being judged, and now I'm mentioning that rain, you know, that there's judgment about rain, then people can say, oh good, both of those are in place, and I can have Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret and know that we have to hope for the best by way of the rain. I can mention God's powers of rain and start praying for the rain at the right time and asking for it in Baruch.
God is the power of rain. God judging God?
No, God grants rain, remember. Bahayah and Shemo, we looked at Deuteronomy.
He is the power of rain.
So if we... God can withhold rain any minute. So really it does get back to whether or not we've done our part to bring about God's favor of the rain. But on the other hand, we say independently of that, it stands as a both and, that God is deciding on the rain for the world, on the Sukkot Shmini Atzeret. So that if you've done your tshuva on Yom Kippur, even though I'm making the two come before like the Midrash did, the earth and the rain, and then possibility for Adam to live, the humans to live, there's also the notion, right, you have the Aretz, you have human beings on Yom Kippur, we do tshuva, we do the best we can, we do all the commandments, and then God sends the rain in the seasons. And that was the Deuteronomy theology.
The judging the rain. Is it judging the people who are praying for the rain, or are you already judging the
people? It's both. I'm saying that it's both ends by way of the rabbi. You could see that there's a stream of thought that says God simply looks at the world and knows all the creatures in the world, and God has to then apportion and judge the rain out there. And does God, you know, please God get it right? There it is. Like it's a little bit of the Bilbul of the. It's confusing in the sense of how it works both ways. But God has to judge the amount of rain, and God is the keeper of that rain, and God can withhold that rain if we're not doing right.
So maybe it's I think it's the word judge. Maybe
portions.
Maybe I can say we're hoping that God makes a good estimate of the needed rainfall.
Right. Right. So maybe that's a better way to understand that. You know,
yeah,
hopefully.
That's when it finally clicked with me.
Yeah. Hopefully that's the way to see it. I can talk about it as apportioning or estimating the needs or.
How about decreeing the destiny of rain of the world?
Yeah, of rain for the world. Decreeing the destiny. All of that can be part of that. And we know, based on the Deuteronomy passage we saw last time, that if we misbehave, if we're not, v'hayayim shmo tishmu, the second paragraph of the Shema, if you really do and listen to these commandments and do them and perform them, then God sends rain in the seasons. So it exists simultaneously. Will God still provide what he estimated, even if we're not doing so right? You know, maybe we can hold out some hope that God at least apportioned the right amount.
All right. Stupid question time.
Henry,
I had a couple.
Henry, do you have more than just one?
One of which was the prayer for rain or not, or stopping it, is done at the Musa, right?
Okay.
When it starts.
Shacharit, you have one prayer, Musaf, you have...
Well, it starts at Musaf.
It starts at Musaf.
But you have Mashiach Ruach HaMurid HaGashem now in Shacharit too, like a daily Shacharit, you're going to now add it to...
No. But I'm saying the transition point is between Shacharit and Musaf.
Well, you don't say it at Shacharit on Shmini Atzeret, but you do say it on Shmini Atzeret.
One thing, on that holiday, Shacharit's one, and is there any significance to that as to... I mean...
We're going to get into that in the Gemara. You're foreshadowing what we're going to get into and see the text ask
then
same question.
Stupid question number two has to do with what you said something about Havdalah, about when you could start carrying, and you sort of implied that you should be saying a Havdalah prayer before you really start your own transition from the end, you know, Shabbos ends and
the
ordinary days. But however, you have, I mean, I learned somewhere else, but you in some other tractate, You have until Tuesday to say Havdalah.
No, you have until Tuesday to do that ceremony. So you're exactly
not
right.
Not the Havdalah prayer.
Correct. So you're exactly right that
so
the rabbi...
you shouldn't really be carrying until you say the Havdalah prayer.
You shouldn't carry, you shouldn't light a fire, you shouldn't touch shmukza. You shouldn't touch that which is forbidden
okay,
to you.
You meant, that's what I want to say. You meant to say a prayer before you do those things that you... couldn't do
the Nusach I even use is that the Havdalah is the extra insertion in the fourth blessing of the Amidah, the weekday Amidah, that you say at the Mariv at the conclusion of Sabbath. The ceremony, as you're saying, can be done until up till Tuesday. But that's the ceremony piece.
And what's the significance of the ceremony as opposed to the prayer?
Okay, so the ceremony, what I explained in just before, was that there were really two. One is not, and I'll expand just a little bit. One is you went home, and since not everybody at home, since not everybody at home was at Maariv to say the blessing, in the classical way we understand practice, you need to now go home and make Havdalah for everybody in the house. That's one way of looking at it. The other way, and my argument by way of liturgy studies kind of approach to this is, why do you have a repetition of something that's already done? Why do you need a ceremony? Well, if you look at where it's stemming from, in terms of the literature of the sages, it's stemming from the same place where we as adults tell a story and we create rituals to actually tell the story. So my contention is that it's actually done for the children. And that when you get home, the adult level has been done, if you will, Atachon Antanu is the prayer. You come home and you do all this. Now, it's a very beautiful, there's very beautiful symbolism in there to capture the spirit of Shabbat and to affirm godliness going into the coming week. But it's fantastic how they develop that in Tractate Pesachim. The last chapter of Talmud Passover, Pesachim, when they're talking about the Seder.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is relevant, but I was thinking as we were talking about this that it's really imitating Bereshit. And this is at the time when we're about to go into Bereshit, where in other words, he created the waters, the separation from the waters to land, and then human being to Aretz. And so maybe one of the reasons I was thinking that they're requesting rain at this time is it's a relationship to Genesis, which we're about to go into, and it those sort of mirrors.
Nice. I like it. It didn't say anywhere yet, and I don't know that it does, that you ask for rain at this time.
We also read about the flood, right?
Yeah, right. It doesn't say anywhere that we begin to say this because we're winding our Torah to Bereshit, okay? Mm-hmm. The reason why it's not going to say that is because though that there's some distinctions between Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael by way of Torah reading, we're talking about some of this culture being Eretz Yisraeli. This is Israel culture.
Okay.
And remember that the Israel culture was not to read Bereshit every year anew.
Okay.
From the beginning of the story, they had a triennial cycle to finish the Torah reading, and you don't always get chapter 1 of Genesis, what we call Genesis,
in that
cycle.
Is that where we get a triennial practice in some shuls?
Yes, a triennial cycle.
From
a triennial cycle is an ancient Eretz Yisraeli practice that has a couple of different systems out there in terms of organizing the readings over a 3-year cycle. And so I don't think you could have the trust that every reading cycle would have that, and therefore the kind of linkage to that wouldn't make total sense all the time. Though, in Babylon, that would make sense, because it was immediately changed. We've got to get through the Torah. It seems to be so... Well, let's say there was a disconnect, 1 week to the next. You're reading this section, you're reading that section, and we don't really get that whole sense that we finished Torah, right? And the celebration of Simchat Torah, by the way, where we really make something big of the reading of Bereishit, doesn't happen until the Middle Ages, so we don't even have that to rely on.
Okay.
Okay.
Just
yeah, yeah. Good, good. Gemara accepts this objection, goes to this Rosh Hashanah suggestion, and it says, Ditnan in Rosh Hashanah, Uvachag nidonim al amayim. We get the waters are judged, the rainfall is basically decreed, as we said, on Rosh Hashanah. And since it was taught in that Mishnah on the festival that people are judged in regard to water, in terms of what they will really receive, we have to make evident that we really know God is the power behind the rain. Right? What could we be thinking? What could be the power? Let's say that already people were very aware of seasons and their times and what was natural and what was not natural. Right? We're not just going to say that it's a seasonal thing or that there is a God for rain who comes and rides the chariot in and provides it. This is God, our God, the one God, who is the power for rain, as much as this is anything else. Consequently, what? Tana! May matai maskirin givura gishamim. When do we begin to mention the powers of rain? And so it's appropriate that now we are going to mention when do we begin, because we've been studying Rosh Hashanah, and we're in Moed, and we're in the holiday Seder, the order of the Mishnah, and this goes right along with it, because it's this time of year that comes around. Gemara questions the language of the Mishnah. V'litnei, but let the Mishnah say, Me'ei matai maskirin al ha-gishamim. Let it say, when do we begin to mention rain itself without gevurot gishamim? My gevurot gishamim. What's meant by the powers of rain? Gevurot gishamim. Rabbi Yochanan says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mipnei sheyorzin bigvurah, because rain descends with the power of God. Shenemar, Osei gedolot, ad ein cheker v'niflaot ad ein mispar. As it says, let me bring you a verse, who performs great deeds beyond comprehension and wonders beyond number. You see that there's a note that says, Maharshan Baha amended the text to read V'ain instead of Adain to conform with Job 5:9. The version cited in our editions of the Gemara corresponds to Job 9:10. However, it does not seem that the Gemara refers to Job 9:10, for that verse is not connected with any mention of rain, unlike Job 5:9, which is immediately followed by a verse which discusses rain. So, in other words, you have some discussion in the Middle Ages about which verse we're really learning this from. Just as, again, these discussions are live discussions. The quote-unquote absolute best text comes from looking at multiple manuscripts and not just accepting the one Vilna edition is the point. The one Vilna edition printed. Because we know that there are manuscripts floating around with different kinds of words attached and what have you. Okay. Uchativ hanotein matar al pnei haaretz v'shaleach mayim al pnei chutzot. And in the following verse it's written, who gives rain upon the face of the land and sends water upon the face of the outskirts. So what the nifla'ot that God does, it's that the water is coming to the face of the land. This is Job chapter 5. Right? Job, very important text by way of God's powers and by way of God's telling you that God is the one who has all the power, and you have to definitely recognize that in terms of your theology. Gemara asks, my mashma, how is it implied that by these verses that rain is associated with power? Amar Rabba Bar Shila. Rabba Bar Shila says, Atya cheker cheker mi b'riyato shel olam. It emerges from an analogy between the word comprehension that is written in the first verse cited above in reference to rain and the same word comprehension that's found in connection to the creation of the world. Here, in reference, it's written, who performs great deeds beyond comprehension. V'chitiv hatam halo yadata im lo shamata Elohe olam Hashem borei kitzot haaretz lo yi'af lo yiga ein cheker litzvunato. And there, in the connection with the creation of the world, which is in Isaiah, don't you know, have you not heard, the God of the world, Hashem, creator of the ends of the earth, does not weary or become tired. His wisdom is beyond comprehension. Uchtiv, and it's written that God displays this power at creation, Mechin harim bechocho nezar bigvura, who sets mountains with his strength, who is girded with power. Right? And why do I need to associate this power of rain with power, with the power God has to create? Because I want this liturgy, Mashiv Haruach HaMoreh Gashem, in the second blessing of the Amida, which is about God's powers. I'm not just talking about a request for rain. I'm talking about the powers that exist. And it's beyond our comprehension, the powers of rain that God has. Rain was such, we said last time in the introduction, rain is such a miracle in the ancient world, and so needed, and they're so dependent on it. And we want to associate this with the one God of our tradition. And so we want to say, Atagi bor le'olam Adonai mechayei meitim atarav loshia. God, you are the God who has such power that you have life and death in your hands. You can revive the dead. And you are the one who causes the wind to blow and the rain to come. We want to make that association. And that's where we go to next in the Shemona Esrei. Umanalan dif tefillah. And how do we know really that we should say this in our prayers? The Tanya, we see in a Braita, which is this rabbinic text from the age of the Mishnah, La'ahavat Hashem Eloheichem ula'ovdo b'chol levavchem. To love Hashem your God and to serve God with all your heart. Ezehi avodah shehi b'lev. What is work? What is worship that's in the heart? What's the service of the heart? Have omer zot tefillah. That's tefillah. Henry, this is kind of now getting into the landscape of your question. Are we talking about Musaf for a reason? Are we talking just in general about prayer? And if it was in general about prayer, would I start with Shacharit? Or is there a real good reason that I'm starting in Musaf? Right? So keep that question that Henry asked in mind. We're not going to answer it just yet, but it is now getting into this whole prayer. Uchativ Batre, and so immediately after that it's written in verse, V'natati matar tzachem b'yito yurel malkosh, and I'll provide rain for you in its proper time. And we know that we're talking about prayer and readings in tefillah leading to rains in their proper time. So now that we've got this link to the Deuteronomic texts that tell us that our observance and our avodah, our service, shel halev, of the heart, is prayer, and that we should recognize God's power within the prayers we say, and recognize that it's stemming from readings we have within the prayer service, which now include both the Shema, because we've made the Deuteronomy connection, and we all, quote unquote, we know our literacy, just, you know, the hypertext flag to literacy about our prayer service is, you know, that, light that light again. Ah, we're talking about the tefillah, we're talking about our Amida. Ah, when I mention the Deuteronomy verses, I know I'm talking about Shema and the verses that I recite when I know that I have an obligation based on Talmud of blessings for Kriyat Shema, for reading the Shema during my prayer service. And since I now see that the rabbis have done this work to get the mentioning of this power within the Amida, that understandably I made a theological statement about in the Shema, but I didn't really mention anything of God's power there to have it other than reading a passage of Deuteronomy, I now need to say liturgically, yes, I recognize that this is you, the powerful God who sends the rain.
In those sections immediately following the Shema, the thing is talking about if you do the right thing, the rain will come.
Correct.
And if you do the wrong thing,
that's the middle section of the Shema.
Right.
And that's what's being quoted here.
Yeah.
from Deuteronomy 11.
Doesn't it make it chutzpah to pray for rain if rain is a consequence of you're doing the right thing? Then isn't it like chutzpah to independently just pray for rain?
Well, it's not chutzpah in the run of the blessings up to that barich blessing, right? I'm only really requesting it again in barich. But what have I said before that? You give me wisdom and discernment. You send me to do tshuva. You accept me and you redeem me, right? I recognize, I'm asking for that in a certain sense, but I recognize that at the same time. I also recognize you're the source of healing, so please heal. I recognize you're the source of blessing, God, so please send rain. You have a recognition component in those middle blessings in addition to the request, so I don't know that it's all about chutzpah there, though it's always chutzpah in our human condition to really say, give it to us now.
I think you know what I mean. If in order to get rain you need to do good, then by doing good you should be getting the rain, not by asking for it.
Well, we articulate in many ways the goodnesses that we have before God. And I spoke this year, told you the story about learning and sitting with Avi Weiss, and we were all expanding on this notion, right, that we have a vidui of sin, we have a confession of sin. We also have this notion within poetic liturgical texts from Rav Kook and texts before that of spilling out the good. Right? God wants to know us. So I don't think it's only about a spiritual chutzpah. I think it's about the possibility that God wants to know us and wants to know we're striving. With Baal.
Baal, the Mesopotamian god, and wasn't it to see whether or not rain came, and God brought the rain? Wasn't that on the top of the mountain with Elijah?
Well, God does bring the rain to soak the offerings there, and even though they're soaked, they really are burned on the altar in the right way for the God of Israel, right, as opposed to Baal. But what you're pointing to is that there are many stories where rain seems to be at the control of the prophet or someone. And we're going to get to some stories actually later on in our Gemara where it seems to be like somehow even beyond chutzpah that we're really, there are some stories that it's going to be real chutzpah. And who's got some control of this? Like, so we're going to see that actually right now. So I want to, with a little bit of time left, now like we left off last time and said, it's about the resurrection of the dead in addition to the rain. We really haven't answered the question, why that particular connection? That we haven't done yet. But we have gotten a little closer to understanding that our ancestors for sure saw rain as an incredible, incredible blessing, also that it was this divine gift, and that God has this unique power. And even though we sense that it happens in its seasons and in the right ways, and generally there's enough this year, but there's a drought over here, but that it comes routinely, we still want to attribute that to the one God in heaven. Here's where three unique powers are going to be bundled, and we get the first kind of real connectivity going on with the powers that we're mentioning in the second blessing of the Amidah. Let's take a look, 2A3 on the right side. Another teaching from Rabbi Yochanan comes on a similar theme. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Shalosh maftechot biyado shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There are three keys on Kodesh Baruch Hu's key ring. God has three keys. Okay? Those keys are Shelo nimsru biyad shaliach. And by the way, God has three keys, and they are not given to any shaliach. They're not given to any agent. God keeps those for himself. Now, again, you asked about Eliyahu, so keep in mind Eliyahu in the back of your mind, Elisha in the back of your mind. Keep these things in mind. The Gemara is going to go there. The Eluhain. here are the three keys. Mafteach shel geshamim, the key to rain. Mafteach shel chaya, the key to childbirth. Mafteach shel tichyat ha-metim, and the key to the resurrection of the dead. So now we have an expansion of the powers we're really talking about. We're talking about the power of rain, power of childbirth, and the power of resurrection. These are three serious powers that God has the key to, and God doesn't send them by way of shaliach. He doesn't put the keys in other people's hands. Now, the Tosafot will have a little bit of an issue with that. Shloshim avtechot shalonim suru l'shaliach. Okay, I'm on the... It's actually the last narrow line of the Tosafot and the first wide line. We're going to get to the pouring of the water, by the way. So it's really, really foreshadowing. Henry, what you just did is the best foreshadowing. I couldn't have planned that better. That was Yishakoach. Okay. The intayimar v'ha amrinan. If you, but really, they say, but if you say, here's what we know from the Gemara, the mafteach hageshamim nimsarin le'Eliyahu. They say, but Elijah had the key to the rain. V'chein mafteach shel tichyat ha-metim, and also didn't he bring back somebody from the dead, with the woman and her son? Didn't he revive this kid? I mean, he brought him back from the dead. Whether or not you thought that was CPR, or you thought that was some, you know, we don't have exact medical records. We're not digitized in that time. Today, someone might say, 1,000 years later, just go back to the digital archive. Who knows? V'chein, the Elisha, and also the prophet Elisha. And that was in Sefer Malachim. By God's life, let this kid live. And it says also in another chapter, and how do I respond? That when I understand what the Gemara is trying to say is that sure, God has these powers and God can, for a moment, let Elijah, Elisha become prophets who can revive the dead. You may feel, and this I'll you know, fast forward to modernity, you may feel you have some power to control and see clouds. You may feel like you can do something miraculous in childbirth, create neonatal care, emergency neonatal care. You may feel like you have something you can do by way of reviving the dead, right? We have these incredible CPR trainings, and we have these defibrillators, and you may feel as though there's some shlichut, there's some agency that you now have, but God, what? Lo nimsuru me'olam deha shel tichyat ha-metim v'shel kishamim nimsuru elo lo nimsuru l'shaliach lihiot la'olam memune aleihem. That there will not be a complete passing along of those powers to you. So even though you're getting better, you're getting better, you're getting better, understand that God really reserves those powers as God's powers, and you, who have some of this agency, only have agency by way of God's bequeathment of those powers, and only to a certain degree. And in that, understand you have to recognize God's power through the liturgy, and that's why it fits all here, Atagi Borla Loman and I, and when it says Michaei Meitim gives life to those who are not in this life, maybe the word metim is used expansively here to mean those who have yet to come into this life and those who are going out of this life, because childbirth and death, that God is the one who's really the one who's the giver of life and death, and what comes in addition to that? The power of rain. And with rain and earth, human beings were able to live, according to the Midrash that I opened with from Genesis Rabbah. This limud will bring us into some discussion in the next class of how do I know that these are the three powers? Do I have textual proof that God has these unique three powers And have I chosen the right three powers? Should I be saying something else in terms of this liturgy? Will be a question that's asked through the hermeneutics of the Gemara. They don't ask it so explicitly. But I'm suggesting that with one part of the Gemara that we're going to see next time, there's even the question, did we get the three exactly right? Should it be four, maybe? You know, is there another power to include? So the question I leave you with is, you can think about this. If you were thinking about what three powers went into liturgy should be mentioned in Atagi Borle Laman and I, God, you are the great power of the world, then what would the powers be that immediately we might be thinking ourselves? If part of prayer is to enter the liturgy as poetry that opens your own prayer, then what might I be mentioning during that time that I recall God's great powers that I would want to add if I was really going to be, in terms of a prayer life, generating some recognition of God's powers beyond those that the Gemara is talking about.
Thank you.
Baal
HaTov. Yochanan is the teacher of Eliezer and Yehoshua.
Yochanan ben Zakkai.